Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. You may be seated. Justice O'Connor is on her way. She'll be joining us when she arrives. The first case is 07-152, Pietro Cristino versus Ministry of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. Mr. Miser. Excuse me.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Ben Miser for the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. If I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
This dispute belongs exclusively in the Court of Claims because it is a suit against the state on a settlement agreement, which is, of course, a contract. Mr. Cristino cannot get around this clear jurisdictional rule by saying that he's seeking equitable restitution because he satisfies none of the three elements for equitable restitution that this court identified in the Santos decision. First, Mr. Cristino is not seeking to get back any money that passed from his possession into the Bureau's possession. Second, he cannot identify any specific identifiable funds to which he's entitled because the amount in controversy is very much in dispute. And third, no statute or rule entitled him to what he's asking for here today. What the workers' compensation statute entitled him to was a continuous stream of benefits. What he's asking for now is something different. He's asking to modify a settlement agreement that bargained around that continuous stream of payments.
Counsel, the argument's all about the application in Santos. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
In Santos, were recipients of compensation required to write checks back to the Bureau?
Santos involved the subrogation scheme that this court had struck down in Holton, and it was a class action.
Right, but did the recipients have to write checks back to the Bureau to reimburse the Bureau?
It was a class action, Your Honor, and so the facts varied for the individuals who were involved in the class action. I don't know if some of those individuals wrote checks, but in any event.
Well, but that's your argument. They had the money and they had to give it back. But in fact, they didn't write checks, did they? The Bureau just made a deduction from future benefits. Isn't that the way it worked?
I don't know if any checks were written, Your Honor, but one of the key distinctions between this case and Santos is that the Santos plaintiffs were entitled to that money by statute, and there was no contract involved. By contrast, no statute entitled Mr. Cristino to the money that he's seeking.
Well, no statute entitles them to an alternative of a lump sum benefit over a payout over their lifetime?
The statute says that he has a right to receive a one-time lump sum settlement.
A statute is involved.
A statute is involved insofar as it allows him to enter a settlement negotiation. But the statute didn't say that he was entitled to a certain pot of money. The difference here is that the workers' compensation statute.
Well, let me tell you what I'm wondering about. I'm really wondering about this. You're here on behalf of the Attorney General's office, right?
That's correct.
The Attorney General raised all kinds of cane about prior untoward things that were happening at the Bureau. Now, it seems to me there couldn't be anything more untoward than to lay in a sub silentio 30% discount and then use an out-of-date actuarial table. Now, we don't know whether that's true or not. That's what's alleged here. But if that's true, why doesn't the Bureau just own up to it? Why doesn't your office, as the Bureau's lawyer, say, look, you cheated these people, let's pay them and not give these class action lawyers a bite at the apple? Why should they get involved? Why shouldn't the Bureau just cough it up if that's what they did? And if they didn't do it, what's wrong with fighting this out? If your position is this is wrong, this is untrue, what's wrong with fighting it out in the common police court in Cuyahoga County?
Your Honor, The reason that it's not proper to fight it out in the Common Pleas Court in Cuyahoga County is because the state has not waived its sovereign immunity in the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas. The state has waived its sovereign immunity on contract claims only in the Court of Claims. And in this case, it's important to remember that we're only talking about jurisdiction.
Well, the state doesn't have sovereign immunity. The state, the Constitution doesn't give the state sovereign immunity. It says quite the contrary. The state's not immune, but the legislature shall determine where an action against the state may be brought.
That's correct, and in the Ohio Court of Claims Act, the state has only consented to be sued in the Court of Claims on contract disputes like this one. And it is important to remember that, regardless of the merits of the underlying case, this is only a discussion of jurisdiction at this point.
Okay.
And the state would be happy to talk about the merits if it were properly brought in the Court of Common Pleas.
Well, why talk about it? If the state's wrong, why not? I mean, we went through the same tussle over the subrogation. After this court ruled, the Bureau fiddled around for a long time before they paid up. So if the state's wrong, why not pay up? And if they're not wrong, why not just fight it out in Cuyahoga County?
Because, Your Honor, as this court's case law has established, a court that is without jurisdiction cannot do anything in a case. The Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas is without jurisdiction in this case. So any judgment that they would enter would be null and void. Jurisdiction lies only in the Court of Claims in this case.
Can you bring a class action in the Court of Claims?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Can you bring a class action in the Court of Claims?
Not against the state on a contract or on a cause of action sounding in fraud.
So that's the bottom line. You want each one of these people that may have been cheated to fight it out one at a time with individual lawyers. Is that the position of the Attorney General?
It is not the position of the Attorney General. A class action could be brought in the Court of Claims.
Well, you just said they couldn't.
If I misspoke. I meant it couldn't be brought in the Court of Common Pleas. If I said Court of Claims, I did misspeak.
Okay.
I'm sorry. But under this Court Santos decision, equitable restitution lies only where plaintiffs are seeking to get back money under a statute or rule, and under an invalid statute or rule. And the plaintiffs here are not seeking to get money that they were entitled to under a statute. What the workers' compensation statute entitled Mr. Cristino to was a pot of money of an indeterminate size. And every other week, on a biweekly basis, money would go into that pot, and the pot would keep growing as he continued to receive the benefits for the rest of his life. That's what the statute said he was entitled to. What he wanted and why he entered the settlement agreement is because he wanted to know exactly how big his pot was going to be, and he wanted that pot up front. And so the difference here is that he's seeking damages on a contract that entitled him to a pot of a certain size up front rather than a pot that kept growing under the statute.
The size of the pot up front, is that not controlled by a statute?
It is not, Your Honor. It's controlled by the contract, by the settlement agreement to which Mr. Cristino agreed. And he agreed to that for good reasons, because getting the money up front entitles him to A, the certainty of knowing how much money he was getting, and B, the time value of that money up front. Mr. Cristino cannot claim that he's seeking equitable restitution on a settlement agreement because he wasn't entitled to that settlement agreement by statute, and it wasn't money that he had ever paid into the Bureau. And this points up the difference between...
There is no statute providing for settlement agreements.
Revised Code Section 4123.58 entitled him to the continuous stream of payments.
Say that again.
4123.58 entitled him to the stream of payments. 0.65 entitled him to enter a settlement agreement with the Bureau. But the settlement agreement with the Bureau, as provided by statute, doesn't entitle him to any certain amount of money, to 100% of net present value. It's a settlement negotiation. And this points up the difference between damages and equitable restitution as remedies. The Corbin Treatise on Contracts explains in Section 1102 and 1107 that damages as a remedy is about putting the plaintiff in the position that he or she would be under a fully and fairly performed contract. So it's about...
There are no statutory parameters to the settlement. In other words, once someone is deemed to be permanently injured in a certain percentage, which would entitle them to a stream of money over a lifetime, there is nothing that says how you calculate it if you ask for the lump sum. There's no rule and there's no statute. It's folks sitting over there at the Bureau that can just strike any deal they want.
No, they can't strike any deal they want. You're correct that there's no statutory parameters, but it is a settlement negotiation between two parties.
Well, are there rules that handcuff the people at the Bureau in terms of how they determine what that settlement can be if the, say, a 50% disability has been determined for the permanent disability? Are there rules that they have to operate under when they sit down and do a lump sum settlement?
There's no rules that define the settlement negotiation. However, the Industrial Commission then reviews that. There's a 30-day waiting period. During that 30-day waiting period, the Industrial Commission reviews the settlement to determine whether or not it's unconscionable or clearly unfair. And in this case,
what is the source of the claim that there's been a 30% across the board discount taken on the calculation of the lump sum?
Mr. Cristino alleges that the Bureau knocked off 30% from the 100% net present value of his claim.
I know what he alleges. What's the source of that?
What is the reason that the Bureau takes that deduction, Your Honor?
Yes.
Because if the Bureau paid out every single claim at 100% of net present value, it would not remain solvent. It can't possibly pay out every claim as soon as it's entered at 100%. There are good reasons that the Bureau has a fiduciary duty to the Workers' Compensation Trust Fund.
If an individual takes a lump sum payment of the present value of a lifetime settlement, that person is discounted 30% of what they would normally receive.
It's not that automatic, Your Honor. This is a settlement negotiation, and these are individual cases. And so in the individual case, the Bureau makes an assessment of what is a good value for it to settle the claim out at, and what is a good value for the claimant to receive the claim out at. But it's important to remember
if I understand it correctly from what you've just told me, if an individual agrees to take lifetime payments, that person would receive 30% more than that person would receive in a net present lump sum settlement. Do I understand that correctly?
That's not precisely correct, Your Honor, because as I explained earlier, the person who's continuing to receive a stream of benefits sees that pot continue to grow. And so the amount of money that person receives over his or her life depends on how long that person lives. Whereas the settlement agreement is the claimant deciding they want to know exactly how much money they're getting, and they want to receive it right up front. And so it's a guess. It's based on a guess about how long that person is going to live. And that guess is based on tables.
Well,
and
part of the claim was that the life tables that have been used to calculate this are out of date. Are you using what's in the code for calculation on those expectancies?
Sorry. The tables that the Bureau uses are based on the Bureau's own experience with permanent total disability, or PTD, claimants. So it's not based on the average life expectancy for the general
population. Not based on the tables in the code, in the revised code.
It is not based on the tables in the revised code. It's based on the Bureau's own tables. But it's important to remember that the questions about the settlement negotiations all go to the merits. And a settlement negotiation is an agreement to enter into a contract. As this court explained in Continental West Condo Association, it is axiomatic, and I quote, that a settlement agreement is a contract to terminate a claim. This is a contract and a tort claim that belongs in the Court of Claims, where then the Bureau would be happy to talk about the merits of the case. If I may reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Meiser. Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case, Pietro Cristino, and the certified class of injured workers he represents. I'm also joined by Craig Bashein and Frank Gallucci, my co-counsel. This case is very straightforward. It was filed 6.5 years ago under the premise that there are individuals, PTD, permanent total disability recipients, who are entitled to additional money from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. Each of them had elected to receive their lifetime benefits in a single lump sum payment. In Mr. Cristino's case, this was offered to him with the explanation that he didn't need a lawyer, it was simple mathematics. Mr. Cristino finds out later when conferring with Mr. Gallucci some 2 years down the road that what in fact had happened was that his lump sum benefit was calculated not using the statutory tables, but using the Bureau's own tables, and more significantly, that a 30% discount had been taken. That's in addition to the discount that is taken to reflect the time value of money.
Is your claim then based on fraud committed by the Bureau of Workers' Compensation arising out of some tortious activity?
There are allegations in the complaint that sound of fraud, certainly, that these people were misled.
Well, if that's so, doesn't that belong in the Court of Claims?
No. Equity also provides relief for fraud. We cited a couple of cases in our merit brief that equity will step into fraud and will vitiate the fraudulent agreement or fraudulent transaction. That's a longstanding principle. In fact, in their reply brief, I didn't see that they refuted that. So there are elements of fraud that certainly will allow damages. We're not seeking damages here. We are seeking equitable remedies, and equity will step in to remedy fraud.
Could I ask you just a larger question? If, in fact, this is a dispute about the calculation of the present value of a lifetime of payments prescribed by statute for certain classes of individuals, what difference does it make what court you're in, whether you're in Cuyahoga County or in Franklin County or in the Common Pleas Court or the Court of Claims? I mean, aren't the merits of your case what will carry the day? And why are we fighting? Why do we engage the Ohio Supreme Court to determine what court you belong in?
Correct. Now, I stand here as the appellee. I didn't ask this court to step in this time. But to answer your question, Your Honor, it's not about which court we're in. It's about what remedy we're seeking. We can't get equitable remedies in the Court of Claims. And if you send this across the street, they are going to start arguing that the whole complaint is based on equity and must be dismissed. Right? They are not going to lay down once we're in the Court of Claims. If you want equitable remedies, you must be outside of the Court of Claims. Court of Claims can't grant that. So that leaves us in Cuyahoga County.
Well, you've just told me that your claim is based or arising out of fraud.
Right.
And there are elements of equitable relief and elements of legal relief.
Right. To establish
so,
legal...
So my point would be that the amount of money that you're seeking will be, if I understand it correctly, a recalculation based on using a correct table, if in fact there has been an incorrect table used for determination of benefits, and an additor of 30% or whatever percent you can establish has been not paid out in the calculation of the life sum.
Correct. For us to go into the Court of Claims and argue legal fraud, we would have to show a deliberate intent to deceive. That's very difficult. It's much easier for us on an equitable remedy to just show that the agreement was tainted with fraud, that is, there's a misrepresentation, intentional or not, and then we get our recovery. Right? That's the difference. We're not seeking the jackpot damages that we would get in a legal action.
How do you have fraud when it wasn't intentional?
Well, equity will reward an agreement, or will reward a party who has been deceived. That is,
how are they deceived when, I don't understand the basis of your legal claim if you say that there's no intention to deceive.
These people all elected for a lump sum payment. They were not told by the Bureau representatives that it was not being calculated correctly and that there was this 30% discount. Right, that's the element of deception. These people did not understand what they were getting themselves into, and equity will remedy that.
Does the Court of Claims have power to make a declaratory judgment?
I would have to say they could.
And they could declare that the Bureau improperly calculated these settlements and award damages.
Right. You know, I don't want to put all my eggs in the basket of declaratory relief, though. I mean, I'd rather go to a common pleas court, have the full panoply of equitable remedies, and be armed and ready to go. And
you have
equity,
to overcome the hurdle that you're allowed to do that.
Yeah. You know, bear in mind...
question of whether you want to. It's whether the law allows you to do
right.
that. And if you're seeking damages on a contract settlement with some elements of fraud, both those belong in the Court of Claims according
right, right.
to the law.
The word settlement was tossed around a lot by counsel in opening argument. And first of all, I'd like to know where those settlement agreements are in the record. Second of all, I'd like to know where he's getting this information that there was this negotiation going on. There's no affidavit from any bureau representative, to my knowledge, stating that, oh, we negotiated with Mr. Cristino and came up with this agreement. That all appears in their reply brief for the first time, this contract argument. In the 8th District, we were arguing about tracing. In their merit brief here, they said that this was a fraud action. We demanded a jury. Now in their reply brief, it's a contract action, and it belongs in the Court of Claims. There is no contract in the record. It is not established. And there was no negotiation. Mr. Cristino had a statutory right to permanent total disability benefits over his lifetime. He won. There was nothing for him to concede. His claim wasn't contingent. He didn't need to negotiate. He elected for a lump sum payment, and the Bureau has yet to provide that.
Mr. Flowers, I had a question about that, too, because I didn't see any contract anywhere in the record. And so what is the evidence of this settlement agreement? Where are we to find what the settlement agreement is?
There is none. It's not there.
Everything was verbal?
And
it just is represented then by a payment?
It's not in the record. I personally know from my client's file, we haven't gotten to the merits of this case. This case has been bouncing through the court system like a yo-yo. What I know is that there is a document he signed, and all that does is reflect the agreement, that he was getting this lump sum payment for closing out his file. That's it. It's an election of how to receive your benefits. And he's told by the Bureau representative, you don't need a lawyer for this. You're just getting your benefits. Now, just to be very clear, we all agree that the Bureau is allowed the first deduction. That's to reduce it to the time value of money. Traditionally, that figure is around 5 to 6%. That's okay. The second thing they're doing is a second deduction, the 30%. They're lopping that off the top. And no one knows that they're getting this 30% haircut. This case really is not dissimilar from Ohio Hospital Association, which is a case this court decided in 1991. There was no instance in that case of the plaintiff first held the pot of money, the plaintiff gave it to the agency, the plaintiff then wants to hold the money again. That's not what happened. It was about Medicaid reimbursement rates. The agency had changed the rates, so they're only reimbursing at 88% instead of 100%. The hospitals banded together, sued, and said, we want the 100%. You owe us 12% more. This court agreed. And when the agency argued, oh, no, you know, we can't be sued for money damages. We get to keep what we collected under the invalid regulation. This court said, no, it's an equitable remedy. There's no immunity for that. Now, Ohio Hospital Association did start out in the Court of Claims. There was a claim for damages there, so they had to do that. But this whole analysis came in under the agency's argument for immunity. And that's precisely the same result here. We all agree that the Zelnak case correctly states the law. It's a 10th District case. They've cited it. We've cited it. They've cited it because the defendant won. We've cited it because the analysis is correct. In Zelnak, the court said, look, when you're only trying to force the agency to do what they're supposed to do, that's equitable relief. They have your money, they have the ray, you're trying to get it back. That's equitable. The plaintiff lost in that instance because the Bureau had actually foreseen that they were withholding the money improperly and paid it. The plaintiff was left seeking interest, and interest is a legal remedy. So they had to go to the Court of Claims to get their interest. That's the same situation here, albeit the Bureau is not voluntarily paying anything. We stand here today with the benefit of some 400, 500 years of equity jurisprudence at our disposal. Cases here, cases in Great Britain. They don't have one that buys into this idea that restitution is only available when I hold the money, I gave it to you, I want to hold it again. Not a single case they've cited says that. They've only got 9 or 10 cases cited in their merit brief. I read them all. There are some examples of equity stepping in that situation. But none of them say, that's it. That's the only time you can get disgorgement. And that wasn't the case in Santos, Your Honor. Santos, we had two subclasses. Mr. Bashine and I are very familiar with Santos. One was indeed some people who had written a check to the Bureau. But they were the minority. Angel Santos himself never paid the Bureau anything. He didn't give them the money and then demand it back. They argued that themselves, the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. They said Angel Santos can't be a class representative because he never wrote a check. That was rejected by every judge who heard it. Now they're here saying, oh, Angel Santos, he's one of these people who wrote a check and wants it back. Not true. The vast majority of these people, their money went straight to the subrogated party, either through the Bureau or from their lawyer's trust funds, never went to the person who then wrote a check themselves.
Counsel, when the Santos case was decided by the Court of Appeals, you folks dismissed this, right?
No.
You thought that controlled until we decided Santos.
Right. Mr. Bash and I went to Judge Mattia. Actually, Master Angelo was there. And we told him, you know, the 8th District just ruled against us on this jurisdictional issue. There's no way around it. You need to dismiss. He had actually ruled the other way, which he later was proven correct, so he had to reverse himself. Then we went up to the Court of Appeals. They just said, we're following Santos.
So you thought you were done until we decided Santos, and then you decided, well, this is the place we're supposed to be, is in the Cuyahoga County Common Police Court. Let me ask you about the statute that allows the lump sum. Is there no guidance? Is it just a freewheeling deal over there at the Bureau on lump sum settlements?
Yeah.
No statute and no regulation that controls how they do this?
Hey, I thought I heard counsel say that there's a statute that allows them to negotiate a lump sum. If he's referring to 4123.64, he's misspoken. That statute allows the Bureau to issue a unilateral lump sum. That's not something that's negotiated. They impose it, and then that decision's reviewable. There's no statute, to my knowledge, that allows negotiations.
Mr. Flowers, wouldn't that be 4123.65, which talks about the approval of final settlement? That
settlement agreement.
That was going to be my question as well. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that statute allow for this to happen?
Right. That allows for settlements of claims, true. There may be documentation, not in the record, but in Mr. Cristino's files, citing that statute. But that's not what happened here. Here it's just, you know, you can get your benefits over your lifetime, or we can pay them to you in a lump sum. What do you want? And most people take the lump sum. They believe it's been reduced to time value, and it's the mathematical equivalent of their lifetime of benefits.
So in your merits, you're going to be arguing that the information was not adequately communicated to the plaintiffs, that there would be this discount for the lump sum immediately.
Right. And this appeal, this proceeding for the Supreme Court, is the first time we've actually heard the Bureau acknowledge that this second 30% discount is being taken. All before this, they've mummed up about it, and it seems like every time we're about to start discovery, they file an appeal. But that's going to be the crux of it.
Has the class been certified?
Yes.
And what does it include, or who is in that class?
The class, there's two subclasses, I think, divided up over whether or not the claimant had an attorney. But it's every PTD recipient who elected for a lump sum payment.
And then if those are agreements, I assume that there's a 15-year statute of limitations, so we go back 15 years on these. Am I right about that?
Well,
is that included in your class?
See, I think it's going to be a 10-year statute of limitations for equity claims. It's not a contract action. You know, we're not arguing and never have argued that they've broken contracts. That's something they've argued in their reply brief. Our argument is that, you know, these people elected for a lump sum benefit, the Bureau has yet to pay it to them. The Bureau is still holding that money. And that's what the 8th District said. You know, just to bring this up, so we're all clear here, this issue has been in this court before. I mean, we were here under Cristino 1, and this court just flat out issued a one-sentence ruling in the wake of Santos that said, reversed, proceedings remanded based on Santos. There's no language in there about the Court of Appeals reconsidering their views in light of the Santos decision. It was a flat out reversal. This court had the same lawyers making the same arguments, albeit there weren't briefing and oral argument in Cristino 1, but the same arguments as Santos, and this court reversed and sent it back. And I have to assume that if there was a jurisdictional problem back then, 4 years ago, that case would have been the 8th District would have been affirmed, and the proceedings would have been over. That didn't happen. So under the law of the case doctrine, in which this court respects, the Schaefer versus Westfield case points that out, we shouldn't even be here. I mean, it was decided the first time this case came up to this court.
Counsel, I'm looking at the statute 64. Is that the procedure under which it is done, or is 65?
No.
64 is something else.
64 deals with lump sum settlements. I think that's what he's referring to. This was not a 64.64 settlement. 64 is mandatory unilateral. The Bureau says, look, we're paying this in a lump sum. If you don't like it, you can appeal it. That's what 64 does. You know, that's not this. You know, just to sum up, the statute that matters is a statute that provides these claimants with permanent total disability benefits over their lifetime. They're statutorily entitled to that. There's nothing for them to negotiate away. There's no need to. They elected for a single lump sum payment, and the Bureau has yet to pay it to them. They're entitled to 30% more, and they're entitled to whatever difference we realize when we use proper mortality tables. That's it. It's an equitable claim seeking equitable relief, and it's in the proper court.
You've used your time, Mr. Flowers.
With that, we'd ask you to affirm the 8th District. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meiser, you saved a little more than a minute and a half of your time.
To answer Justice Cupp's question about whether or not there was a contract here, Mr. Flowers just acknowledged that Mr. Christino signed an agreement to receive a lump sum payment. This is not a case where the statute of frauds is relevant. An agreement is a contract, and it's an agreement to settle a claim. There was then an agreement in this case, and that agreement illustrates why Mr. Christino is in fact seeking legal damages, not equitable
restitution. Is that in the record?
It's a form C-240 that he signed. It's not in the record. But in order for Section 65, not 64, Section 65 to be relevant, there necessarily had to be an application signed by Mr. Christino under form C-240. And Mr. Christino wants to go back to the day before.
So this, the form is called what?
It's form C-240. It's a bureaucratic
form.
Form
C-240. And where do we look in the record to see the statute or the guidelines that prescribe how that number is determined by the Bureau?
The statute does not determine how the Bureau sets that number, and
And there's no regulation that the administrator of the Bureau has adopted to determine how they arrive at that number?
There is no regulation, but the number is reviewed by the Industrial Commission. But again, this goes to the merits, Your Honor. This doesn't go to the question of jurisdiction. And Mr. Christino is not seeking to go back to the day before Form C-240 was signed. If he were, he would be seeking equitable restitution, because restitution is about putting the plaintiff in the position where he was before the agreement was entered. And that would mean going back to the continuous stream of payments. Damages, by contrast, are about putting the plaintiff in the position where he or she would have been had the contract been fully and fairly performed. Mr. Christino is asking for damages because he wants more money on the contract, which he believes should have
been. Counsel, there's been this argument advanced that if this case is in the Court of Claims, the people who they argue were cheated won't be able to have their day in court in the Court of Claims.
That is incorrect, Your Honor. They certainly can have their day in the Court of Claims, and they can seek all of that they are seeking here today. The Court of Claims, under the statute, says that the court shall have full equity power in all actions within its jurisdiction and may award both damages and full equity powers. So Mr. Flowers was incorrect about the power of the Court of Claims. It could award all of the relief that he's asking for today. We, of course, maintain that no relief is entitled here on the merits, but that's for another day. That's for the Court of Claims, not the Court of Common Pleas. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Meiser. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.